turning this evening in the first place to Isaiah chapter 52 and verse 7. I trust you would recall that Paul makes reference to this also in the reading that we took in Romans chapter 10. In Isaiah's prophecy in verse 7, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. I have in mind that the messenger was to go first, preparing the way of the Lord, and the comfort of Israel was to be proclaimed. Israel were to be restored after their exile, restored to the precious land and holy city. This was good tidings. But the best of it was that the blessing of the people was to be found chiefly in the approaching presence of the Lord their God himself. It was he who said the word. It was by his might that they would be saved, and it was his own glory that would come amongst them. All this was in the message of hope that Isaiah opens in real substance in chapter 40. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Many will know Isaiah 52 verse 13 through to the end of chapter 53 because it has been so often referred to as it sets out that unexpected appearance and work of the Lord's special servant. But it would be good for us to be aware of what precedes that, to take a little time this evening to take notice of it. And as I read chapter 52, I find it very reminiscent of chapter 40, areas that I spoke of last week. But it's from that very point of view that it should remind us that chapter 53, even within Isaiah, not just when we come to know how this fits the picture of Christ, but even within Isaiah itself, this is what should have been known by every reader of the Old Testament, what should be known. But Isaiah itself indicates that chapter 53 was speaking of the Lord himself. The Lord himself appears in chapter 40. Chapter 52 deals with essentially the same things, the same themes. When I spoke of Isaiah and the themes of Isaiah some time back, I made the point that you can find recurring themes, but developing and progressing as you go through. Very few different themes, but a constant development of them as he returns time and again to them. That's what you find from chapter 40, chapter 52. Just for the sake of our purposes this evening, I mentioned those. But chapter 52 is speaking of the Lord coming. Look at that strident proclamation at the end of verse 7. Your God reigns. That's at the heart of the message, these glad tidings. And it's from there that we move straight into the appearance of the Lord's servant and what he is doing. It is speaking of the Lord himself. Although, this is where the difficult thing comes for Israel, and indeed for many others. Though it speaks of the Lord himself, we read also, don't we, both in chapter 52, verse 14, that his visage, his face, was marred, spoiled more than any man, and that explains chapter 53 and verse 2, he has no form or comeliness. When we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. That was the difficulty for those who were looking for the Lord's servant at a later stage. But I also suspect that this very connection is why Paul makes use of Isaiah 52 as he does in Romans 10. Because Isaiah 52, indeed all around it, but very clearly those references that he takes from here, Isaiah 52 is about the restoration of Israel. And that's what he's dealing with, by and large, around chapter 10 of Romans. There too, in Romans, Paul has in mind a messenger coming to tell the good news to Israel, as indeed to the Gentiles. But there is a messenger coming. And just as in Isaiah 53, verse 1, this very message, as Isaiah asks, who has believed our report? This evening, looking at this verse in verse 7, but what is around it as well to understand it, I just want to speak about the good message and also about the beautiful feet. And the good message, first of all. As I've indicated in Isaiah 52, there is a message that has been already proclaimed in much the same way previously. But that message is, at its heart, what it is all about, is laid out just in that one verse, verse 7. That good news. There is a messenger bringing it, the feet of him who brings that good news. But what is it? What is he going to do? What is he going to tell? He's going to tell of peace, the glad tidings of good things. He's going to tell of salvation. And he's going to tell to Zion, your God reigns. These are the good things that he will tell Zion. Peace, salvation, all in the coming of their king, the Lord himself, who will reign amongst them. Just to recall the background, Isaiah was prophesying this at a point when Israel had a seriously looming threat over them, that they would be separated from their land. And indeed, that was his message previously. This was the difficult side of the message of Isaiah. That they would be separated. And that was a massive hardship to Israel. And for those with any spiritual insight, it would be a sign to them that the Lord himself was placing a distance between himself and his people. That's what they would understand from that. If they were taken out of the land. That was a special blessing, if you think back to Abraham. It was a key part of the threefold, or some would say fourfold blessing to Abraham and covenant there, that they would have the land. And now they wouldn't have the land. What does that say to us about the relationship with God? And those with some sensitivity would grasp at least the liability, the potential, that they might become an entirely lost people. It's in that setting that this word comes from chapter 40 onwards, this message of hope and comfort. And at the heart of it is this very point, Zion, that great city of God, where God had chosen to dwell, they were to hear the message, your God reigns. He is your God. Yes, you will be sent away, but the time is coming when he will be there in the city that he has chosen. He will be king. In other words, there will be a kingdom. You will be that kingdom. You will be restored. And who will be the king? Not a David, not a Solomon, not all those who fell by the wayside or some who did do well, but it will be God himself. They would see this God working in might and in salvation. Salvation that is proclaimed in verse 7. Salvation that is spoken of in that the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God in verse 10. He would be working, making bare his holy arm. It's just such a picture in language, isn't it? If that's what you do. If you're going to do a job that needs strength, you roll up your sleeves. You'll see your mighty arm. They would see that. and those he speaks of in verse 9. This is his redemption. This is his comfort, that the people would be restored. How else could God reign unless he had a people that he would restore to that place? I also want to take you back just for a moment to remember the Lord's commission to Isaiah in chapter 6. If you were to think back to that, it's a powerful image there. But you realize, as the commission goes on, the Lord is sending Isaiah. But as he goes on, he speaks to Isaiah and says, essentially, you're going to spend a lifetime extending my message, both of destruction, punishment, judgment, if you like, and of restoration. But just with this message, as much as with the message of judgment, most will not believe. Their hearts will still be hard. There will be this wonderful message. You might understand if somebody said, no, I don't want to believe that judgment is coming. But to have a message that, yes, even after that judgment, there will be restoration, wouldn't you believe that? Wouldn't that be pleasing? But even that, chapter 53, verse 1, who has believed our report? Even that is not believed, is not accepted. And they would therefore not benefit from it, even this glorious message. Which reminds us that as Isaiah opens up this message, in verse 7, for example, there is always that implied question behind it. You hear this. What are you doing with it? You hear this. Won't you believe it? Why else does he come to that place in 53:1 to say, who has believed our report? All the time it is raising this question before the hearer. Will you believe? This is what God says. Will you believe? That is the very question that lingers, that is still present, as Paul raises the issue of the nation of Israel in Romans chapter 10. Paul was a man steeped in the Old Testament. He would have known these words well. And if he knew them well as a Pharisee, surely he knew them even better when he realized how Jesus had opened up himself through this very passage. And so Paul brings this to the New Testament. He is especially interested in the Jews in Romans 10, but no less the Greeks as well. He doesn't make specific reference to it, but there in Isaiah 52 to 53, you see the peculiarity of the Lord's servant. In 52:13, he shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Although in the next breath, just as many were, as this version has it, astonished but appalled, not astonished as we mean it these days, but appalled at you. He'll be exalted. He'll be the one on high. Just as many were appalled at you. Because your visage, his visage, his face was marred more than any man. This is the Lord's servant. This is the, if you like, the tension, the dilemma that most people face when they first meet him. That's what the Jews struggled with. They were looking for the Lord's servant to come, great and mighty, and a conqueror. They couldn't cope with one who at the very same time, as it were, would appall them at the very sight of him and all that he does. As the New Testament expounds the message of Christ, it is the finest of messages. But in one sense, and at purely human level, it ought not to surprise us. Who will believe it? How can these things be? Although the Lord reigns, that is the proclamation in 52:7, although the Lord reigns, that reign will first be seen in the face of a man with no beauty. It will be first seen in the face that is marred none other than the face of Jesus on the cross. And it's possibly with this very much in mind, that shame of the Saviour, that Paul recalls, whoever believes on him will not be put to shame. The contrast as he turns things around. What is required is a confidence in that message of verse 7. Your God does reign. How is he going to do it? He's going to do it through this servant, the one who will be exalted, extolled, and very high, although in the first place you will see him and be appalled at him, as chapter 53 does go on to speak of, doesn't it? He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. Can't help but think of the way that God, when his glory passed one or two of his servants, he hid their face, that they couldn't see his full glory, or they would die. And here, men hide their faces from the one on the cross. What this message requires then is to see beyond that shame and to see the salvation. Just as the child Jesus, the shame began even then, laid in the feeding trough in the stable. That child Jesus was announced, and there the angels, who are heavenly messengers, that's what the word angel means, they said as well, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. And further on, the angels together say, glory to God in the highest, and on earth, peace, goodwill toward men. The salvation of God coming amongst his people according to his promise. And that, just in summary, is to highlight what this good message is about, this good news that is brought by the messenger. And then also I want to notice the beautiful feet. Feet can be funny things, can't they? It seems like at the moment in our present day, with lots of money to spare, feet are the new black. Pay them plenty of attention for some reason. But here it's talking about a messenger on the mountains. Messenger in the east. Perhaps coming in this scenario, coming from a far country in the east, trekking over the Judean hills to Zion. Certainly not by car, perhaps even not by horse or camel. But his feet, no doubt, would be dirty and dusty, perhaps gnarled and hardened by the journey. And yet, he carries this message. It is his feet on the mountains that are beautiful. It's not his feet, is it? It's a way of describing just how joyous it is to have a messenger to bring this good news. I have a vague recollection of reading some old stories, perhaps from the pioneer West in America, or from those isolated Yorkshire moors in Victorian England. And part of the story is there, the family is at home, and there's someone away, and they're just longing for news. And then somebody appears over the hilltop or over the horizon. There's that little puff of dust. Eventually he makes it to their house and he's got good news of the one who's left them. And it seems like the story would be that poor man who has trekked so far with that message, just a message, he's wrapped up in the arms of that family, almost as a substitute for that person who's missing, because he has good news. He's a simple, undistinguished, filthy messenger perhaps. But he's brought in and he's treated to the best, and those feet are looked after. He is not the person they've been waiting to hear from. He's not the person who's been the focus of their attention all the time. But because he's brought news of them, that messenger is the perfect object for their excitement and their appreciation. It seems to me that's something of what must be in mind in this proclamation. Paul indicates how it's all the more so with the message of salvation and the coming of that sovereign Lord. That sequence that he has from verse 13 in Romans 10 through to the beginning of verse 15, where he uses this reference from Isaiah. In verse 13, whoever calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. But then he has a question. How can they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher, messenger? How shall they preach unless they are sent? And it's then that he comes and he says, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace. Salvation depends on calling on the Lord, which in turn depends on believing in him. Believing in him depends on hearing of him. And that depends on having the message preached. But the message can only be preached if that depends on the preacher being sent with a message. And who sends? It can be none other than the one who has that message of salvation, who is God himself. And that's where the big question lies, I think. That's where the challenge lies for Isaiah and for Paul. In chapter 53, verse 1 of Isaiah, in verse 16 of chapter 10 in Romans, Lord, who has believed our report? If these things are so, this is the puzzle. Who has believed? They have not all obeyed the gospel. The message is good. It is glad tidings of good things. It's a fantastic message. Our God reigns. In Isaiah and in Paul's mind, what that warrants is a very high regard for the messenger because of the message he has. If this message is so wonderful, our God reigns, and because he reigns, there is an immense salvation offered to men. What does the reception of the messenger or messengers suggest about the reality, about the way that men do receive the message? Remember that little story I told you from the American West or the Victorian Moors? Are the messengers welcomed? Do we delight in the messenger? Are they honored because of the message that they bring? Admitted, their feet are usually ugly, perhaps. But that's not really what matters, is it? It's not their feet, per se. Are they recognized, rather, for their quality? What they are doing, what they are about? They have walked, they have come to proclaim the message under that commission, that sending from the Lord, even as Isaiah himself. And quality is where real enduring beauty must be found. It seems there are two points to be made about this. And the first is to ensure that the messenger is indeed sent, using the word of Paul. Does he have the real message? Does he carry it by commission of the king to proclaim the king as his herald? And when he brings the message, does he keep it true? Is it faithful? Is he faithful to that commission? I don't want a messenger who goes out there over the prairie and comes out and he thinks to himself, well, I need to make the message good. There's absolutely no need for that in this case. The message is of the highest quality in itself. The messenger must be faithful to that commission, not tarnish it, not blur it, not mix it. And perhaps we should ask, in this particular case, the messenger himself. Think of that messenger, the one who comes over the mountains bringing this good news. He's coming to Zion. Would he not stay there himself and share under this sovereignty of the Lord? The messenger is to share in the benefits of what is to come. Paul himself was about that. We've been constantly reading that, how he doesn't want to let go of what he has himself. He's about sharing it with others. Do I convey the sense of the glorious terms of this message? If the messenger in any way turns it down, tries to level the field, would it be any wonder if others don't find enthusiasm for it? If others don't believe? If it's not that important? But to come with excitement that God has given this message. Isaiah is a case in point. He had no encouragement whatsoever from those around him, but he stuck at it. He was deliberate about it because he knew it was quality. So that first question, what about the messenger himself? Is he bringing the good news? But the second question, if all that is present and correct, what about those hearing the message? What about yourselves? Myself whenever I open the scripture. Every one of us who hears. What does this say about us? What about that picture out there in the dusty township in the American West? The messenger has brought his story. What do you think if the next scene is him trudging back up that dusty street, just looking for somewhere to lie down, looking for someone who would give him a drink? It's not just the treatment of the messenger that's questionable then. How precious is the message? This reference in Isaiah says that if he's got such a great message, give him regard too. And if the message is not precious, then how do we regard the one whom the message promises? And that's the final question. That's where it comes down to. Do we stir in our hearts to hear the messenger say, "Our God reigns"? Isaiah brought that message, and he asked, "Who has believed our report?" These remain problems for Paul, so many years later, as he again looked on Israel. Israel, who had heard this first by the mouth of Isaiah, what a thankless task it was in a way. And we may well say, at least as far as Israel is concerned, this remains a problem to the present day. But it continues a problem too for the Gentiles, the Greek. Paul says it's the same for everyone. And how many have heard this message and have not given a thought, have not regarded the feet of him who brings this good news, this good message? Have seen no beauty there. The message means nothing to them. Just those few things regarding this wonderful verse, this wonderful message of God through his prophet. Just to close, and just say for myself, I would endeavor to bring the message of the gospel. I have no complaint about my treatment as a messenger. Yet we must also face up to it in the wider scheme of things. Gospel messengers, not for themselves being themselves, but as gospel messengers, will often be held at arm's length. There will be a church minister who will do many other things as a minister and be well appreciated for it. But if he brings the gospel in its fullness, there are times when he is held at arm's length. He may be full of enthusiasm, himself touched with the glory of this message, and everything else is done, it's received, it's heard with great formality, and this is the way things are done. He needs to be supported first of all to be a preacher, to be this one. He is sent by God. We trust he is sent by God. That one who is sent is a preacher to proclaim the message of salvation, this simple, straightforward, all-encompassing message. Our God reigns. He's an ambassador of the Most High God. He needs that supported first, regardless of anything else. There's nothing so important to hear. This was the lifeline for Israel. Many rejected it. But it's the lifeline for man to know that God reigns. As I say, I have no complaint for myself, but I felt I can preach this text today. I felt I should, because I know there is another gospel messenger coming. And I commend him to your care. I commend him to your appreciation. I commend him that you would see the beauty of his feet. Of course, it's graphic language to say, appreciate him for what he is, what he's doing, for the sake of that message that he would bring. Just as this man who comes over the mountains has gone to immense lengths to bring that message because he is devoted to his master who has sent him, he's devoted to the message itself, he's devoted to the people that he brings it to. Appreciate him for what he's doing, and above all because he represents the Lord himself who sends that very message. That's exactly what Paul is about, reminding us that where it comes down to is all because this man is sent with the gospel. The Lord calls upon you to treasure that message above all things, for in that you will find life. And so together, let God's people rejoice, messengers and all, for our God does reign. May he bless his word to his own praise amongst us here tonight. Let us pray together.